With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, this is Mark Kermode. Thanks for downloading this Kermode on Film podcast. Now, as you probably noticed, we've gone past the midway point of the year. Actually, we've passed it by quite a few weeks, indeed months. Usually, when we get to the end of June, I like to do a kind of roundup of my favourite and least favourite films of the year so far. So, although we've had a whole bunch of other stuff going on, particularly with me and Jack ranking our Christopher Nolan favourite movies and all that sort of stuff, I do want to do the top and bottom 10. So, this is the first of two podcasts. In this podcast, I'm going to run down my 10 favourite films released in the UK in the first 6 months of 2020. So January, from the 1st of January right through to the end of June. Now, obviously, this covers the period of lockdown. So some of these films won't have been released in cinemas. Generally, I only do cinema releases, but obviously a bunch of cinema releases were only released direct to streaming during the months of lockdown. So this is the first of two podcasts. In this one, I'm going to do number 10 to number 1 of my favourite films of the year so far. And as I said, this is everything up until June. So some of the films that I've loved since June aren't going to be in there. That's why, for example, things like St. Francis, which I raved about recently, aren't in there. So here we go with my top 10 favourite films of the first 6 months of 2020. And it goes without saying, this is just personal opinion. And some of these films you'll like, some of them you won't. And I'm sure that there'll be your own choices of what I should have included or what I should have left out. So let me know what you think. So here we go. Starting at number 10. So, at number 10, a film which opened to streaming services on May, didn't get a theatrical release in the UK, although it was absolutely due to get one. It had been playing at the Berlin Film Festival, where I missed it, unfortunately, The Assistant by Kitty Green, which is a terrifically chilling and insightful Me Too era drama about workplace harassment and abuse. In the wake of the Harvey Weinstein scandal, there have been loads and loads of news stories about just how much harassment there is within the film and TV industry. But the really brilliant thing about The Assistant is that it broadens out the scope of its story, so it isn't limited to specifics. We don't see the face of the central figure who causes so much grief and sadness and unpleasantness at the center of The Assistant. What we see is the reactions to his actions. I think it's a brilliant central performance by Julia Garner. I think the film is all the more powerful for just how understated it is. I mean, it has a really chilling edge. It is a really visceral portrait of something which is a horrible circumstance in which our central character is constantly undermined, is living in a toxic environment in which harassment and abuse can not only survive, but are actively nurtured. And I think one of the things the film does really brilliantly is it portrays that that toxic culture in which, as I said, the culture of abuse and the culture of mistreatment is not just allowed, but positively encouraged to thrive. So at number 10, The Assistant.
You know, you can always come to us, right? Come to us first, okay?
The last two checks don't have a name or anything, just the dollar amount.
Ignore it.
Okay, and will he know what it's for?
Yep, he'll know.
I wouldn't sit there.
Never sit on the couch.
Here and here, initial here, sign there.
Do I need a lawyer or something?
Do you have a lawyer?
What's happened? Where'd you go?
I was worried for this girl. I mean, they were just like laughing about it.
Can you deal with this?
Hi, why me? Who was that?
Waste of my time.
Your
and I, we're excited for you. It's a great opportunity.
What can we do?
Do about what?
On to number nine, and at number nine, a film which I recently discovered was released in the United States under the history The Shadow of Violence, with a poster which made it look like a kind of gritty crime thriller. It's completely not that at all. It was released here under its original, and I think it's much more appropriate title, Calm with Horses, inventively adapted from a story in Colin Barrett's Young Skins collection. It's a striking directorial feature debut from Nick Rowland, who was BAFTA nominated for his 2014 short Slap. And it's this really brilliantly immersive tale of tortured masculinity and divided loyalties that pulls the viewer right into the mindset of its haunted protagonist. Set in rural Ireland, and it has something of that kind of West Country Western flavour of Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. It's a fable about failed fathers and false families. It's unflinching in its depiction of grim realities, but it's laced with a redemptive transcendence that reminded me of films like Lean on Pete and The Rider. At the centre of it are two brilliant performances by Cosmo Jarvis and Neve Algar. And I think what they managed to do is to tell the story not just through words, but through physical performance. I mean, I'm always really impressed by films that don't rely on dialogue to tell the story. It's a really, really physical film. Also notable for the fact that it has a superb score by Blank Mass. I do a soundtracks show on Scala Radio. I mean, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that I've been playing tracks by Blank Mass from Calm with Horses, which is its proper title. And I think that the soundtrack adds so much to the intensity and the immersion of the film. I think it's a really great movie. I think that the American title is just kind of weird because it sells it as a totally different kind of film, The Shadow of Violence. It's not about the shadow of violence. I mean, obviously you have to do whatever you can to bring an audience in, and anything that makes people see Calm with Horses is great. But at number nine, my favourite films of the year so far, Calm with Horses.
Most people know to stay on the right side of the Devers family. I'm what you meet if you ever find yourself on the wrong side. People say they're troubled, the Devers.
I didn't get the joke, Lex.
But I say all families have their problems.
I don't want him to be around you because of the things that you do.
Wise up, Arm.
Wise up.
Yeah, wise up.
You were never like this before, you know that? Before them Devers got their hands on you.
We heard about this fella.
But we think it's time to finish the job.
We have to do it.
This is not loyalty.
Please.
It's servitude.
On to number eight in my favourite films released in the UK between the beginning of January and the end of June 2020. And at number eight, what a thrill to be able to have an Adam Sandler picture in there. I mean, I have said so many times that for an indication of what's wrong with Adam Sandler's less good comedies is the knowledge that he really knows what a great film looks like when you look at a performance in something like Punch Drunk Love. Well, I think Adam Sandler's performance in Uncut Gems is every bit as remarkable as his performance in Punch Drunk Love. The film is directed by the Safdie brothers, who are an extraordinary filmmaking duo. It's set in the New York Diamond District, and it's basically got a tempo to it that is, it starts at a point of nervous panic, and then it just gets worse and worse through the movie. Honestly, watching Uncut Gems is kind of like having a panic attack, but in a really good way. When I first saw it, it reminded me very much of the same sort of narrative logic as that of Abel Ferrara's Bad Lieutenant. I mean, the film has an arc which you can pretty much plot out from the beginning, but at the centre of it is this fearsome performance by Adam Sandler, who's thrown himself into the role 100%. There was a story that the Safdie brothers at one point showed Adam Sandler a cut of, or I think a working cut of the film, and he watched like the first 40 minutes of it, and he said to them, does it stay at this level of intensity? And they said, yeah. And he went, great. And that's what's so brilliant about the movie. It absolutely grabs you and just drags you along with this central character, this infuriating central character, this maddening central character, who somehow you never, you know, you want to know what happens to him next, even though he's such hard company. Also, another case of a brilliant soundtrack, One of Tricks Point Never, Daniel Lopati's brilliant score, which again throws you right into the world of the movie. I've seen Uncut Gems a couple of times. Both times, it's left me completely overwhelmed. And as I said, the first time I watched it, it was like a kind of rising panic attack. So much so that the person I was watching the film with had to absent themselves from the room because they just couldn't stand the tension anymore. I think that says an awful lot about the Safdie's filmmaking. And brilliant to see Adam Sandler doing such a brilliant performance. And if you haven't seen it, check out Adam Sandler's acceptance speech from the Independent Spirit Awards when he won for Uncut Gems. It is one of the funniest and most pointedly brilliant things I have seen, topped only by the speech given by the Safdie brothers, both of them at the same time. At number 8, best films released January to June 2020 in the UK, Uncut Gems.
You like to win, right? This is no different than that.
Black Jewel, power with you.
This is my fucking way.
You think I'm stupid, Howard? You and your whole fucking family. I heard you've resurfaced your fucking swimming pool. You know how that makes me feel.
Never resurfaced anything. You think your life is more important than my life? I don't know who said that.
I told you about how things were gonna go. You like the way things are going now?
That's my whole family.
Get the kids out of the house.
You having a good time?
Yes.
This is me. This is how I win.
KJ, it's game night. You should be stretching out.
What is he, a coach?
Nah, he's just a fucking crazy-ass Jew.
Which brings us to number 7, and it says something about the number of great films released in the first half of 2020, that a film as brilliant as Personal History of David Copperfield is in there at number 7 and not at the very top spot. I mean, people tell you, oh, cinema today, it's not as good as it used to be. What a load of nonsense. Look how many great movies have been released so far this year. So, Personal History of David Copperfield, I mean, I think that Amanda Iannucci did such a fantastic job with this. Death of Stalin found unexpected laughter in the historical horrors of a story that nobody would have imagined could have been told comedically. In the case of this, what Iannucci does is to take Dickens' endlessly reinterpretable narrative and amplify the absurdist, actually very modern elements of the source. Iannucci and co-writer Simon Blackwell managed to get this kind of surreal cinematic odyssey that is really accessible, really intelligent, really unexpected. At the centre of it all is this wonderful performance by Dev Patel. And one of the things that's most impressive about the film is that it has a brilliant colorblind casting that enables it to have a much wider palette than previous adaptations of Dickens may have had. I think what Iannucci does is to demonstrate that colorblind casting not only can work, but can really improve the accessibility and the mainstream quality of a film like The Personal History of David Copperfield. I know there were some people who got off their bike about it. Oh, this isn't the story that Dickens wrote. You know, any cinematic adaptation is not the version that the author wrote, but there's such joy, there's such enthusiasm, there's such generosity of spirit about Personal History of David Copperfield. Just a whole ensemble cast, all giving their very best, all clearly absolutely thrilled to be in such an uplifting version of this story. I think particularly at the moment with everything that's going on, you need stories that accentuate the positive. And I think that what Amanda Iannucci and his brilliant cast and crew have managed to do with their take on David Copperfield is to take something that, you know, is well known and well loved and has been adapted for the screen many times before, and to breathe new life into it, to give it something that's completely original, completely fresh, make it feel like a totally modern text that is accessible to all audiences. At number 7, Personal History of David Copperfield.
What are you doing?
Medicine, reviving you.
This is salad dressing.
Is it?
Thank you.
Sorry, what was your name?
Copperfield.
Copperfield?
Copperfield.
This is Cropwood Trotterfield.
David Copperfield.
Donkeys! This is a donkey free zone!
Oh,
remarkable woman. Very kind.
Now, I said that one of the great things about Personal History of David Copperfield is how accessible it is. My choice at number six may be seen on the surface as slightly less accessible, but I think it's a really magical movie that anyone who loves cinema could get involved with. At number six, The Whalebone Box, the latest fantastically inventive offering from British maverick Andrew Cotting. Now, if you're a regular here at Kermit on Film, you'll know I'm a huge fan of Cotting's work. I think nobody is making films like Cotting. I think he draws on and builds upon the legacy of, say, Derek Jarman, but he is absolutely his own filmmaker. The story here is of a box that apparently was made from the bones of a whale that washed up on the island of Harris in the Outer Hebrides. And the film follows two journeys, one in which psychogeographer Ian Sinclair and photographer Anonymous Bosch join Andrew Cotting on a reverse pilgrimage to take the box back to its, well, let's call it its birthplace. And the other journey is a journey into the dreams and imaginings of the artist Eden Cotting, who is the daughter and muse of Andrew Cotting. So there's these two strands working together. And yes, there's nothing overtly mainstream about Andrew Cotting's films. They're kind of like cut-ups and collages of sound and vision that throw ideas and places and stories and happenstance and chance connections together. If, like me, you've followed Cotting's career, you'll know that journeys have always been a big part of his movies, going back to something like Gallivant from the 1990s. His films blur the borders between realism and fantasy, between fact and fiction, between documentary and invention, and also between psychogeography and actual physical geography. There really is nobody else making movies like Andrew Cotting. The thing I loved most about Whalebone Box, however, is that you can read it in a number of ways and what the film is about and what its story is about. For me, I thought it was an absolutely beautiful portrayal of the love between a father and a daughter. And I found that the film had an emotional heart that really engaged with me. And I think actually with any audience. I mean, yes, it's adventurous. And yes, it's kind of, it's an art house independent production. And yes, it may initially seem off-putting, but at the center of it is a universal love story that I think anyone can connect with. And if you haven't seen it yet, I would advise you to check out The Whalebone Box as soon as possible. It's a wonderful film, and it's number six in my list of favorite films released January through June in the UK in 2020.
I asked him where the whalebone came from, and he said it came from a washed up whale after the whale had been smashed up as a result of a storm.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
So we're into the top five, and at five, an icily satirical, psychological, sci-fi inflected thriller from Jessica Hausner, who's the Austrian writer-director behind Lords and Amor Fu. This is Little Joe. Now, I have to say right from the beginning that I know from speaking to other people who've seen Little Joe, it's not a film for everyone. I've seen it three times, and it's definitely a film for me. I hope if you're a Kermit on Film listener, you can find it in your heart to give it a go. It's a kind of fairy tale inflected yarn about a genetically engineered plant that may or may not be infecting human minds. Jessica Hausner says that it's a parable about what is strange within ourself. And one of the things I love about the film is it has a brilliant ambiguity. As I said, it's about this plant which is genetically engineered to make its owner feel happy. It releases some kind of chemical that effectively triggers the mother hormone. And in fact, the plant is named Little Joe after the son of the woman who essentially invents it, played rather brilliantly by Emily Beecham. I was talking to Ben Whishaw recently about working on Little Joe and working with Jessica Hausner. One of the great things about Jessica Hausner is that her films are fantastically well designed. There's a kind of Kubrickian level of attention to detail. Nothing is in the frame by mistake. Everything from the design of the environment to the colours of the clothes and the hair and everything you see is all really carefully coded. And I love that as a film critic, watching a movie that just seems to be a complete world, something in which the creator of this world has thought about every single possible detail. But also what I love about it is that the film has the kind of paranoia that you get in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, in which people start to believe that the people around them have changed, and yet they look the same, they seem the same. How have they changed? And it raises the question that if a plant changes you in a way which is so imperceptible, so you don't seem changed, have you actually changed at all? I think the film can be read in a number of different ways. As I said, I think that Emily Beecham is absolutely brilliant in the central role. She has this red hair which mirrors the red of the plant Little Joe. Also, incredibly inventive use of music by Teiji Ito, which sometimes seems so jarringly weird and out of place as to almost kind of shock you out of the film itself. I think it's great. Some people have described it as cold and chilly in a way that they found impenetrable. Not me. I've seen it 3 times and every time I've enjoyed it more. At number 5, the brilliant Little Joe.
Fear can distort our perception of reality.
If I made a mistake, then it's my fault.
It seems that this has all been a bit much for you.
He frightens me.
You're a good mother. But which of your children will you choose?
Good night, Little Joe.
At number 4 in my list of my favourite films released in the UK between January and June 2020 is the terrific feature debut from Lena Matsoukas, who's the Grammy award-winning director of Beyoncé's Formation video and whose television credits include Master of None and Insecure. This is Queen and Slim, which was a film which at one point looked like it was going to catch a number of awards nominations and yet somehow ended up kind of going under the radar, which is a real shame. I don't think it was seen by as many people as it should have been. It's now available for home viewing. If you haven't seen it, I absolutely urge you to check it out. It's kind of a new twist on familiar outlaw riffs that you can trace back through Badlands and Bonnie and Clyde and Abu Dussouf. At the centre of it, we have Daniel Kaluuya, who was Oscar nominated for his brilliant performance in Get Out, and Jodie Turner-Smith. Both of them are absolutely brilliant in the leads. As I said, it's essentially a kind of Outlaws on the Run tale, but it's played out against the backdrop of racially divided America. It is brilliantly scored by Devonte Hines, aka Blood Orange. Once again, it's always important to remember the way in which music has such an impact in movies. And I thought that Queen and Slim did a brilliant job of immersing the audience in its kind of unfolding road movie fable. It was very surprising to me that some people weren't as struck by it as I was. I first actually got wind of the movie because my daughter had seen it and she said she was just knocked out by it. And she said, you know, you have to see it because it's such a terrific movie. And I was working through the movies that were up for BAFTA nominations and Queen and Slim came up and I just thought, okay, this is definitely going to get nominated. And then it didn't, which is such a surprising thing because it's such a bold first feature. It's visually stylish. The performances are really terrific. It reminded me sometimes of things like, I was thinking of Celine Sciamma's Bon de Fille, Girlhood. Occasionally, I was reminded of the Hughes brothers' Dead Presidents, which is a film which I've talked about loads of times and which didn't get anything like the acclaim that it should have got. But the thing that I really like about it is that it was striking and bold and original and universal. It absolutely has a, you know, a treatise and a theme and a message, and yet it is a very universal story that's told in a way that I think anybody can watch and appreciate and be drawn into. It never feels polemical. If you haven't seen it, do check it out. At number 4, Queen and Slim.
What if God wanted me to die and I messed up his plan?
I don't think that's what he wanted.
How you know?
I just think you were meant to be here. I'm scared.
It's all right. I'll be brave enough for the both of us.
I'm taking you dancing. Let's go.
You're willing to risk getting caught so we can dance?
Hell yeah.
Don't worry, you're safe here.
I just want to let you know that I'm okay and that I love you.
I want a guy to show me myself. I want him to love me so deeply, I'm not afraid to show him how ugly I can be. Thank you for bringing us this far. Thank you for this journey.
Please!
No matter how it ends. What do you want?
I want to ride or die.
Can I be your legacy?
You already are.
So we're into the top 3, and at number 3 in my list of my favourite films released in the first half of 2020 in the UK, from the beginning of January to the end of June, is Eliza Hittman's brilliant Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. I really liked Eliza Hittman's previous feature, Beach Rat, which I thought was great. This is a drama that manages to blend the gritty authenticity of a documentary with the poetic sensibility of pure cinema. It's a really relevant and contemporary story dealing with an urgent subject, the matter of reproductive rights. And yet it does so in a way which, again, as I was saying this about Queen and Slim, never feels preachy or polemical. In fact, this feels like a perfectly observed story about female friendship. It's a coming-of-age story with road movie inflections. It stars Sydney Flanagan as a feature first timer. She's brilliant as Autumn, who is a 17-year-old from Pennsylvania who discovers that she can't get an abortion in her hometown without parental consent. And so she has to travel to New York, and obviously she doesn't want to go on her own. And so she is accompanied by her more outgoing cousin, Skylar, played by Talia Ryder, who's soon to be seen in Spielberg's West Side Story. The film is brilliant for a number of reasons. Firstly, it has incredibly naturalistic performances that you absolutely believe in. Secondly, as I said, it deals with an urgent and really important subject, but does so in a way which never overshadows the drama itself. I mean, in many ways, this is more a story of friendship than it is about anything else. But one of the things that's really intelligent about the film is that title, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, refers to a series of questions that our central character is asked when she gets to the clinic in New York. And there is a brilliant scene in which, when she's giving answers to those questions, her silence often speaks much louder than words. I mentioned already in this top 10 how much I admire films in which the story is told not verbally, but through everything else that's going on. We visually see what's happening with the story. In the case of Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always, it is a brilliant example of a film in which the storytelling, the most important parts of the storytelling, it's not what characters say, it's what they don't say. Plaudits to French cinematographer Hélène Louvard, who did such brilliant work on Beach Rats, and here manages to capture moments of really intense intimacy in brilliantly unobtrusive fashion. I think the film could be described as kind of a, you know, the melancholy magic of Schlesinger's Midnight Cowboy and the humanist artfulness of the Dardenne brothers. It's perfectly pitched and sensitively played, and I think it's truthful, powerful, and profoundly moving fare from a filmmaker at the top of her game. At number 3, Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always.
You going to New York? What are you doing there?
Seeing family and stuff.
I used to be on this street.
Who came with you today?
My cousin.
Do you have a place to stay tonight? I know you came from far away.
I'll figure it out.
This area's closed. Cannot sleep here.
Where's the rest of the money? La, 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 la,
la, la, la. I want to make sure that you're safe.
La, 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 la.
I this is hard. I'm gonna ask you some questions. They can be really personal. Just answer either never, rarely, sometimes, or always.
So we've reached number two in my list of my favourite films released in the UK in the first half of 2020. And I have to tell you that I basically wrestled with the position of these two films. And honestly, either of them could be at the number one spot because they're both completely brilliant. But at number two in my rundown of my favourite films released in the UK first half of 2020 is Bong Joon-ho's masterpiece, Parasite. What is there to say about Parasite that hasn't already been said, not just by me, but by everybody else? I mean, firstly, how brilliant that when Parasite won the Oscar for Best Picture, it not only made history in terms of the Academy Awards, but it also really, really annoyed Donald Trump, who complained about it winning the award and wondered why we can't have something like Gone with the Wind instead, which frankly tells you everything you need to know about Donald Trump. Parasite was recently reissued in a black and white version that was actually first unveiled at the Rotterdam Film Festival when I was there doing a podcast with Jack Howard for Kermode on Film. So I've seen it several times in colour. I've seen it a couple of times in the black and white version. Personally, I think the colour version is my favourite version. It was really interesting watching the black and white version because Bong said that one of the things that it did was it drew your attention to the surfaces. When you take the colour out of the picture, what you see is the surfaces. So you see the matte scuzziness of the household, which is at the bottom of society's ladder, and at the top, on the top of the hill, and also at the top of the economic tree, the house, which is all glass and shiny reflective surfaces. You don't see the colour, you just see the surfaces. The story is about two families, one of which inveigles its way into the household of the other family. But the title, Parasite, is clearly ironic because I don't think the parasites at all are the family who inveigle their way into the other household. I think it's to do with the parasitical nature of the socioeconomic structure. One of the things I love most about Bong Joon-ho's Parasite is, in fact, that you can read it as a ghost story. You can read it as a story about haunting, as a story about people living in the same space, but somehow in different liminal spaces. I did say when I first reviewed it that the best thing to do is to see Parasite knowing almost nothing about it. Now, obviously, because there's been so much press and so much attention given to it, and rightly so, it's hard to imagine that anyone doesn't know anything about it at all. But I still think it's one of those films in which the central shifts and changes are so gasp-inducing that the best way of seeing it is without knowing what's coming next. I've been a huge fan of Bong Joon-ho's for ages. Recently, Simon Mayo and I were talking about the Snowpiercer series on television, and he said, well, you just keep reviewing the movie, because I kept saying, well, you know, whatever else you think of the series, it's not the movie. I had the great pleasure of introducing the movie as part of the opening of the John Hurt Center. We showed it on the big screens because it didn't get a big screen release here in the UK. I've also introduced a number of Bong Joon-ho's films on BFI Player. If you get a chance, go over to BFI Player. I do introductions there every week, and it's really well worth checking out. But Parasite is as near to being a perfect film as anything I have seen in recent years, with the possible exception of the film which I have in my number one spot.
부모님 얼굴도 뵙고 좋더라. 건강들 하시고. 일거리가 없으셔도. 네가 내 대신 얘 과외 선생님 좀 해줘라. 영어. 대학생인
축하라는 거야? And so at the number one spot, and I'm pretty sure you've guessed this already, and as I said, it was a real struggle to decide whether it was this or Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, but at number one in my list of my favourite films released in the first half of 2020 in the UK, Celine Siamar's absolutely brilliant Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Now, if you're a regular here, you'll know that I'm a huge fan of Celine Siamar's work, whether it's her directing her accidental trilogy of youth, which is Water Lilies, Tomboy, Bande Fille, Girlhood, or her script writing on Clobaris's brilliant animation My Life as a Courgette. Everything she does seems to me to be somehow touched with magic. In this, her fourth feature as writer-director, she ventures to a new world of the late 18th century, And we first meet the central character, Marianne. She's teaching life study in Paris to art students, one of whom stumbles upon the titular painting, the portrait of a lady on fire. And this then leads us back into the past, into the story of her being sent to a remote Brittany residence to paint a portrait of a former convent girl whose mother wants to send the painting to a Milanese nobleman. If he approves, her daughter will then be married. And we've learned at the very, very beginning that this has already defeated one painter because the subject does not want to be painted for reasons that become apparent during the course of the movie. So what then happens is this kind of battle of wills in which there is a sort of agreement arrived at about painting the picture. But then what happens is it becomes a treatise on looking, on the way in which we gaze, on the female gaze versus the male gaze. There's a central question: if you look at me, who do I look at? CMR herself has described Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which won the Screenplay Award at Cannes, as, quote, a manifesto about the female gaze, which makes it sound terribly kind of bookish and dry, and it's anything but that. This is a film that is vibrant and thrilling and passionate and deals with really heightened emotions, but keeps them absolutely rooted in the firm soil of social realism. There is a subplot about a young maid, Sophie, who is dealing with an unwanted pregnancy. And this subplot finds CMR at her most quietly radical, not just confronting but also depicting a taboo subject and its representation, refusing to look away and finding strength in sorority. I think she is an extraordinary filmmaker. I think that what she's doing is really groundbreaking, and yet it's done in a way that seems accessible, that seems even mainstream. I think anybody could watch Portrait of a Lady on Fire and find something in it that touches them and engages them emotionally. It's such a brilliant film. Even talking about it now, I'm stumbling over my words, because when I start talking about it, I just find what I want to do is stop talking about it and go and watch it again. Sometimes as a film critic, it's very difficult because obviously, you know, film is a visual medium and most films can't be described through words. The very best films can only be described, I think, through visuals. So let me just leave it there by saying my favourite film of the first half of 2020 to be released in the UK, I know it played in other territories before that, is Celine Siamar's absolutely brilliant Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Vous me reprochez la suite. Mon mariage.
J'ai un nouveau sentiment. Le regret.
So there we go. That's my very personal and completely subjective list of my favourite films released in the UK in the first half of 2020, from the beginning of January to the end of June. Just to run that list down again, at number 10, The Assistant. At number 9, Calm with Horses. At number 8, Uncut Gems with Adam Sandler. At number 7, Amanda Iannucci's brilliant personal history of David Copperfield. At number 6, The Whalebone Box from the maverick that is Andrew Cotting. Into the top 5, at number 5, Little Joe from Jessica Hausner. At number 4, Queen and Slim, a film which I don't think got the attention it deserved. At number 3, Eliza Hittman's brilliant Never, Rarely, Sometimes, Always. At number 2, Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, whether in colour or in black and white, it's a masterpiece. And at number 1, Portrait of a Lady on Fire by the genius that is Celine Siamar. Now, I know that that list probably won't match up with your own list, so let me know what you would have chosen. What are the titles that you would have included? What are the titles that you would have left out? Remember, the rules are strict, the beginning of January to the end of June, so nothing released in July or August, please. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at KermodeMovie. Also, go to our Patreon page where there are videos and a whole bunch of extra stuff that you can't get anywhere else. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, remember to subscribe, tell your friends, keep watching the skies, and for the next podcast, my least favourite films released in the first half of 2020.